Hello and welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is Software Alchemy in the Arc of Technology. Alan Cooper in conversation with Chris Shipley. So I'm glad you could be here tonight. It's my pleasure to extend a special welcome to any new club members who are here this evening. We know you'll enjoy our membership and we look forward to seeing you often. So for the questions and answers today, we will be using a microphone over here. Please do use that microphone as this is being recorded. And now I'm going to introduce Alan and also tell you a little bit about Chris. First of all, I'll tell you about Chris, who is going to be interviewing Alan tonight. Chris Shipley is a leading technology and product analyst and CEO of Guidewire Group, a software and services company providing tools to make startup businesses more competitive. Best known as the executive producer of the demo conferences from 1996 to 2009, Chris helped technology companies bring more than 1,500 new products to market. As co-founder and CEO of Guidewire Group, she works with emerging technology companies around the world to identify market opportunities and accelerate business growth. In 2010, she received SDF Forum's Visionary Award for her work with technology entrepreneurs. And that's important because Alan received that same award the very first year, and maybe they'll tell you a little bit about that. Now I'll just give you a very brief bio of Alan Cooper. Alan Cooper is known for his role in humanizing technology through his groundbreaking work in software design. Widely recognized as the father of Visual Basic, Alan is the author of the books About Face 3, The Essentials of Interaction Design, and The Inmates Are Running the Asylum, Why High-Tech Products Drive Us Crazy, and How to Restore the Sanity. We do have those books for sale tonight after the program. As founder of Cooper, a leading interaction design consultancy, Alan created the goal-directed design methodology and pioneered the use of personas as practical interaction design tools to create high-tech products that address users' needs. Now, Alan Cooper in conversation with Chris Shipley.
Thank you very much, and it's a delight to be here. You know, often when we take a stage in an interview conversation like this, we are really excited about, and we talk a lot about what the interviewee has done, and you have done many, many things that certainly earn you a seat on this dais, including in the beginning with some of the very earliest companies involved in the technology, the PC revolution, and moving through the Visual Basic. I think you were involved in interaction design and what now people commonly call design thinking long before that was in the lexicon. But tonight I think we should talk about what you will do, because I think you have a big agenda in front of you. And since you are, in fact, a visionary, and I just play one on TV, we thought we'd try to jump into some of the things that you're thinking about now and open this up then to conversation. You have said that alchemy is transformation, and I think some might suggest that transformation is alchemy. And I'd love you to just dig a little bit, dive in on that for us. What does that mean to you?
Thank you, Chris. And I should say thank you to the Commonwealth Club and to Kevin. And it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you all for coming. I've been trying to find a title for myself for my entire professional career. For a long time, I called myself a software author. The main reason why I use that word is because nobody else did. For a long time, I called myself a programmer, but I wanted something with a little more authority to it. But I've really struggled, and I've struggled up until about a month or two ago, when I was finally given the answer, and I was given the answer by Kevin O'Malley, our MC here tonight. And he, after listening to my story, called me a software alchemist. And I went, that's it, because alchemy, he had to explain it to me, actually. Then I hit myself on the forehead. Because to me, alchemy is hocus pocus and bogus. But alchemy is transformation. That's what it is. And if I had to describe what is software, it is the transformational agent. Any place in the world, any activity, any group of people or anything where you inject software into it, you get transformation. And we have seen so many industries and so many activities and so many avocations and vocations and lives and industries that have been utterly and completely transformed. And I, you know, when I was in school, I wanted to be an architect. And but for that, you actually had to get good grades. So I chose another path. So I got kind of beguiled into the world of software. And it's very much it transformed my life, and everything that I've done has been changed by it. So for me, the title of Software Alchemist is the first one that I think really makes sense in the long term, and I'm using it here for the first time actually.
And so we can see how it flies. Does it feel good to call yourself an
alchemist? It does. It totally does. I mean, it does sort of have that bogus sense of fake science.
I expect you to have sort of that.
I know. I need a hat and the
robes and this sort of thing. You're not thinking.
I'll work on that.
Okay. I think it would look good on you, actually.
But so to answer your question, every discipline, it can be described as either having been utterly transformed by software or is about to be utterly transformed by software. So that's what the future is right there. Can I go now?
I think they probably want a few more minutes of your wisdom. But
okay,
yeah,
okay.
That's good, though. It's interesting to me. I was actually thinking about this, obviously, in advance of coming here tonight, and about Silicon Valley. And Silicon Valley was really founded on hardware. And today, we're hard-pressed to find hardware, even as HP now is divesting itself of its PC group. Silicon Valley, there's not a lot of silicon in Silicon Valley. We really are becoming, I think, a software world. How do you think that... is that just indicative of an proof point for your point here, or do you see that there's something else changing there?
Well, I would dispute your assertion in a polite and respectful way. So you're totally wrong.
Okay.
No, I don't think this valley was founded on hardware at all. I think this valley and its transformation was founded on software and
software embedded in hardware.
Well,
let me get my point in, please.
Yeah. Okay, sure.
Right.
You need the hardware. Yes, it is a gating factor. But I'll tell you is that if it hadn't have been for guys like Gary Kildall, who looked at that little process control 8008 chip and said, that's a general purpose computer, we'd still be in the Stone Ages. It was the software guys that drove the revolution, and it was the software thinking that drove the revolution. And yes, it was, I mean, it's sort of like when you think about revolutionaries, you don't necessarily, you think about the principles for which they fight and not the guns that they held, and yet they needed guns. So I would say that the chips were the guns, but that doesn't make a revolution. It was the software guys. I'm a total chauvinist about software. You may have picked up on that.
Well, by some counts, there are 7,000 startups within a few miles from where we're sitting tonight. And they're all writing software. How do we absorb that kind of transformation if those are all transformative software applications?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, isn't it? It's a real. This is the arc of technology. As I'm trying to answer this question, what is the arc of technology? And what it is it's that history repeats itself over and over again, more than once, again and again, the same way, more than once. And so what you see is you see the patterns. When I started my first software company in 1976, what the status quo ante was giant mainframe computers that cost hundreds of millions of dollars or millions of dollars. And for the first time, small computers were made available for a few thousand dollars. And what it was is this incredible swing from a consolidated world run by the, you know, IBM and Burroughs and NCR and a few big computer manufacturers, to this incredible world of diversity. And there were thousands. I didn't know what the word entrepreneur was when I started my first company, and then there were 1,000 flowers blooming. And that's kind of the cycle that we swing back and forth in, is as we go from diversity to consolidation, to diversity to consolidation. And so in the 70s and the 80s, amazing things happened. And then in the 80s, there was great consolidation. And then more platforms came out in the late 80s. And then the 90s were sort of the dark days for innovation and diversity. And yet there were the great, wonderful, golden days for consolidation. Everybody had a Windows computer. And if you were a software vendor, you had a stable platform. And that was the decade of the software that everybody had, made billions of dollars, and everybody hated. It tells you something about the consolidation swing. And now we're back to one of those diversity swings where the tools that are available on the web are so powerful and so accessible, so inexpensive, that the barriers to entry have dropped just to the rock bottom. I mean, they've even dropped well below where they were in the 70s. And so, yeah, so you get 7,000. I'm surprised it's only 7,000 startups. But, of course, the answer to that is, well, 6,990 of them are going to go out of business or get bought by somebody else, because there will be consolidation. I mean, that's what happens. But you need all those smart people and all those ideas to – I mean, good ideas don't come from one person. And as much as I would love to take credit for you know, all the great inventions that I've, quote-unquote, made, all great inventions actually come from a kind of a zeitgeist, when the whole society, a bunch of people working together on the same problem, slowly begin to talk about their successes, and the common solutions tend to emerge from a lot of people who are pushing the boundaries. So if there's 7,000 startups, many of them are going to fail and shut down, but that's just the company. That's not the people. The people don't die. They'll go somewhere else, and they'll take their thinking and their ideas, and you get this incredible compounding. And that's where the great genius and the huge successes come from.
Yeah, I might argue the point that rather than cycles, we have waves, and they look a lot alike. And I wonder if
is
in
it a
this,
particle or a wave?
Yeah. in this particular cycle or wave, whatever the case, though, because the barriers of entry are so low, will we see consolidation? Could this wave be different, I guess? I mean, we'll certainly see consolidation of companies, right? The M&A activity that naturally comes at these explosions of entrepreneurial startups. But if the individuals can continue to sort of act as free agents in the marketplace and continue to be those software alchemists, is this a different kind of, should we expect a different kind of consolidation mode?
Boy, that's a good question. I don't think so. And the reason why I don't think so is because they're software startups. If they were hardware startups, maybe it would be different. But the thing about software, the remarkable thing about software is it hasn't fundamentally changed one iota in the last 50 years. It's remained at a kind of a constant level of complexity. The tools we have are much more powerful. So the net result of what we get from designers and developers understanding software at the level of complexity at which a smart human can understand the complexity will yield more because the tools are more powerful. But it's but the net level of complexity stays at a common level. And while the productivity is higher, the demands, the expectations are higher. Back in the day when I started writing software, it was on a green screen, and my idea of interaction was it came up and it said, enter 1, 2, or 3 for choice 1, 2, or 3. And nowadays everything is zooming and popping and spinning and rotating in high definition three-dimensional video. But it's still basically doing the same thing. So it's, as usual, it doesn't come down to what the technology can do. It comes down to what the people can do. And it's human cognition hasn't really changed much in the last 50 years. Our ability to understand the technology hasn't changed much. Our ability to understand it as we use it hasn't changed much. And what was your question?
I don't know. I'm so fascinated. I don't even recall. What occurs to me, though, is that again, with each cycle, there's also been this level of abstraction. And you, in fact, are responsible for one of those. By creating Visual Basic, you enabled a whole lot of people who would never have thought themselves to be programmers.
Yeah,
to
I'm
be
sorry.
Programmers. and then we have that now officially tonight. Your apology. I was talking to a group of engineers at a startup camp over the weekend, and one was very excited about this new tool that essentially would allow you to create a PowerPoint presentation and turn that into mobile software, a mobile application. So now there's tremendous levels of abstraction, right? That is effectively messaging to the world, and anybody can be a software architect or a software developer of some sort.
Yeah.
And maybe we're really hitting a point where software becomes more conceptual than actually code. Is that possible?
I'm not buying that. I'm not buying that. I still think that that it's no. Software is hard. It's really, really freaking hard. And nothing we've done has made it any easier. If we have made it more powerful, we have made its capabilities greater, and you have to manage and comprehend and master those capabilities. And I remember it was probably 1972 or 73 when I was taking my first classes in business data processing. And I remember showing up in the common room of the computer center, and somebody held up the magazine, the dominant technical magazine of the day, which was Computer World, and saying, "Look at this headline," and it said, "Programmers made obsolete by third generation languages." And I was getting into thinking I had a career in front of me, see, and I was very depressed by this. And if there's been a consistent meme throughout the years that has been utterly and totally wrong, it is that one. And so there's this idea that somehow we're going to make it so easy that anybody can program. It just flat out ain't true. It doesn't work because people think that they comprehend what they do, and possibly at some level they do. But to comprehend what you do or what you want to do at the level at which it takes to understand how to, pedantically explain that to a computer step by step and deal with all those the choices that crop up, are in fact an incredibly rare human skill. And so. It's like giving somebody, one of those hyper body suits, that they like in Avatar, where you get in the thing and you move like this, and all of a sudden your giant arm moves like that, and everybody goes, "Whoa, that's cool! I want that thing." Except it turns out when you actually sit in it, the first thing you do is you have to scratch your head. It's this is what software is like. It's you'll kill yourself before you can do anything productive with it.
We could say the same thing about the social media movement, right? All the blogging and Twittering and this sort of thing that has turned everyone into a media person or, God forbid, a journalist.
Well, and it's completely, utterly
same thing happening in software.
Made it so that I can't think beyond 140 characters anymore.
Does that mean it difficult to actually be a software alchemist?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's career limiting. Sorry, I interrupted you. You were asking
profound
question.
It's almost
question.
Like it's the same. I doubt it was profound, but I see a parallel there between sort of what's happening in media and the sense of now everyone can create, and therefore we call ourselves journalists or programmers or developers or something of this sort. If everyone can create a set of screens that we can call a software application in some fashion.
Well, what's interesting about it is, back in the day, we used to say, oh, yeah, computers. And people would say, well, what can you do? In, you know, I understand what computers can do in business, but what can they do in the home? And I was reading in the latest, you know, obituaries for Steve Jobs. Even he said back in the day, he said, oh, yeah, you can use it to manage your recipes, Miss Housewife, you know. And this is what I remember saying this, too, in the 70s, is when people said, how would I use a computer in the home? Oh, to manage your recipes. And the reason we said that is because we didn't have a clue what you could do with these computers in the home. And because all this stuff is non-obvious. And you can only discover Twitter after you've played with Facebook. And you can only play with you can only discover Facebook after you've played with you know, online chat. You can only discover chat after you've lived with CompuServe for a while. I mean, you have to go through all these stages before the next one is revealed. And so we tended to, before we could envision all of these different means and modes, we tended to say, well, there's this thing you'll do. But it turns out that there is no thing that you'll do. Everybody does some different variant, and there's room for all the stuff. So it turns out that it took me a long time to understand what Tumblr was. And I realized it's a blogging facility for people who can't blog. And it turns out that it serves a tremendous purpose. Because I'm a geek. I want to figure out how to blog, you know. But there are so many people who have stuff to say and stuff to show, but they don't want to learn how to blog. And so there's a facility that makes that really easy. And it turns out that there are a whole bunch of people who have really profound things to say, but after about the second paragraph, it just comes unraveled. Guilty. So, and that's what Twitter's for. So it turns out that there are a whole bunch of people out there who are incredibly profound in 140 characters. And they don't really thrive in a broader arena. So it turns out that I've been told that I have to be careful when I say it, and it turns out. It's a key phrase. So it turns out that there's a place for Twitterers, and there's a place for Tumblrers, and a place for WordPressers and various blah. And so it's, you know, we tend to want to find a one-size-fits-all answer. And the answer is, it ain't a one-size-fits-all.
So the challenge here is to somehow differentiate between creation by whatever tool and whatever means and innovation. And I'm curious how you think about and define innovation.
Well, innovation is a buzzword that means what you want it to mean, and it's sort of like, you know, the innovation lessons will continue until the beating will continue until the innovation begins or something like that. Innovation to a business person means exploitation of something that is known and has no risk, but we haven't done it yet. Okay? Innovation to an inventor often means doing something we don't know how to do. Innovation to a craftsperson means doing something that we know how to do, but we haven't done yet. And I kind of like that last one because I identify with craft people. That's where I kind of live. I'm not all that interested in inventing new stuff. I'm not, you know, I'm a sort of a recombinant guy. I guess that's what all inventors do actually, is they take pieces from others and put them together in new ways. I'm just rambling here and not making any sense at all. Innovation, that's a tough question to ask, because what it does is it's kind of innovation is in the eyes of the beholder. Actually, what I'm fond of saying is that innovation is in the hands of the hands-on. It's because there are so many people standing at arm's length and saying, you guys go off and innovate, but not recognizing what that innovation looks like. In order to really do innovation, you have to get down and get your hands dirty. You have to talk to users, or you have to work with code or work with chips. You have to work with the tools. You have to cut wood or, you know, cut metal.
I mean, I'm fond of thinking that, that invention is when something new is created from whole cloth that we didn't sort of imagine before. But innovation is the stuff that people actually use.
Well, innovation, that's why it's exploitation. And so you, it's a matter of, it's, you know, innovation is a cereal company figuring out that that I used to take a raisin bran and pour a little bit into a bowl, and then I'd take granola and pour a little bit into that same bowl, and that's how I'd make breakfast cereal in the morning. And
so someone put them in the box for you.
Somebody put them in the box for me. So now you can get raisin bran crunch, and it's raisin bran and granola mixed together in a box, and that's innovation. There's a great book. There's Scott Birkin's book, The Myths of Innovation. I highly recommend it. He just tackles the myths of innovation. There are so many myths. And as a student of cognitive psychology, what you learn is that people want it's the fundamental attribution error. Is we want to know who gets the credit or who gets the blame. And I'm as guilty of the fundamental attribution error as anybody. I'm always saying, well, that's screwed up because that guy blew it. Or I say, you know, that thing is great because that guy totally was prescient and saw the great thing. But it's a completely bogus model of innovation. And in his book, Birkin really, really describes how innovation really takes place. And it's a slow moving forward in the unknown. And it's almost always recognized as innovative in hindsight. I mean, I have to say that the things that I've done in my career that I think were really innovative and prescient, nobody knows about and nobody cares about. And
did you know at the time? Did you say that I'm doing this thing and it's going to be innovative?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it turned out to be, who cares? And the things that I get lionized for were things that just seemed like off the cuff, no big deal at the time. And that is, in fact, what innovation looks like. It looks stupid. There's another great book, a guy named George Gilder, many years ago wrote a book called Microcosm. And he's a crazy man, let me tell you. But he writes about how the real innovation is utterly unexpected and stupid. And, of course, we're all today, now, every one of you has a radio in your pocket, right? It's your telephone. It's your mobile. It's a computer and all that stuff. And the great example that Gilder uses is that about 25 years ago, probably even less than that, pretty much every single telephone call in the world went over wires. And every single television show went through the air. And today, every single television show goes through wires, and every single telephone call goes through the air. And if 25 years ago somebody had come up to you and said, guess what? The entire communications infrastructure, both video and audio, are going to swap places, you would say, you're a complete idiot. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And that, folks, is what innovation looks like.
It looks like the stupidest thing you've ever
That's
heard.
That's exactly it. It looks like the stupidest thing you've ever heard.
Well, this is a dilemma for business, because business has sort of smacked its collective forehead and said, we've got to be more innovative. And if you sit to a boardroom of any fortune-sized company, in order to be innovative, you got to be stupid. You got to, you know,
yeah.
It's got to be.
Yeah.
They would laugh you out.
I know. Well, it turns out. I mean, that's exactly correct. And it turns out that you can either have an efficiently run organization or you can have an innovative organization, but you can't have both, because I mean, efficiency is a concept that comes straight out of industrialization. By operating efficiently, you have economies of scale, you can drive your costs down, which means you can drive your price down, which means you can get broad distribution of your product, you can make things available to a wide number of people. And
which all sounds really good if you're a venture capitalist or an investor.
Yeah. And it's totally, and the thing is I'm not going to argue with it. In the industrial age, that worked. Okay, and it turns out that, I mean, it's like, you know, there are other ways to improve, and there are other ways to innovate and make more money and make your product better. But the fact is if I can make a product better, but that guy over there can make his product for cost half as much, then he's going to beat me every time, except for a thin layer of rich people who can afford to buy Maseratis. But the thing is in the world of software, all that efficiency, all the value of efficiency drains away. It goes away because there's no economies of scale in the world of software. Once you build a piece of software, you can push a button and a million copies of it are in a million different places. There's no cost of raw materials. There's no cost of transformative labor. There's no cost of transportation. And so there's no economies of scale. And what happens is in an industrial world, your advantage as a business person is in improving your bottom line by focusing on your bottom line. By reducing costs, you can reduce your prices and you can drive up the amount of profit you make. But in the world of software, there's no direct relationship between cost and price. So if you drive your costs down, it means you just make a cheaper product, a lousier product. And it doesn't give you any advantage at all. And yet it's deep in the genes of good managers to be, to save money. And in the world of software, what you want to do is you want to create a product that people love. That's the top line management. Is if people love your product, they'll pay. Look, I mean, Apple is, the poster child for that. They will pay if it's something they love. And so what it means that you as a business person, you're sitting there and saying, we're spending X dollars. And if you have a MBA, you know who you are. You were trained to drive costs down, and that's wrong. Because it gives you no advantage. Instead, what you should be doing is you should be saying, I will spend whatever it takes to put into my product whatever it takes to make people love it. Because then they will love it, and they will pay whatever I need to charge them in order to make an incredibly huge profit, because they'll pay. They will. And it's a completely different mindset for business people to come at the problem, and it makes it really problematic for well-trained business people. The Clayton Christensen, the great, I think he's at Harvard. Is he at Harvard? He's this brilliant business. He's an academic, but he studies business, and he wrote this book called The Innovator's Dilemma, and He just published a really interesting blog post where he says, the pursuit of profit is guaranteed to kill all companies in the long term. I love it when an authority like that is so clear and unequivocal. It just warms my heart. And that's because the pursuit of profit, it says that what you do is you, as a good business person, is you go where you can make the most money. But the problem is where you make the most money tends to be the kind of rarefied atmosphere of your biggest clients. But the opportunity always comes from the bottom, from your smallest clients. And this is what his book, The Innovator's Dilemma, is all about. And so what you have to be doing is, as a good business person, you have to constantly be thinking about, how can I put myself out of business? And you have to be asking that because you know that if you're not, somebody else is. And when they put you out of business, they'll put you out of business. So you have to be saying, how can I do it? So Microsoft has never wanted to put themselves out of business. What they wanted to do was they wanted to find things that would make Windows go to more platforms, you see. And their pursuit of that vision has taken them out of the center of gravity of the software world, and they're slowly becoming more and more marginalized, and they're not going to recover from that. Whereas you look at Apple, where the invention of the iPad is a direct existential threat to the MacBook or the iMac, and if it wasn't Steve Jobs threatening his own livelihood, it would be somebody else. But as it is, the Apple gets the advantage, and Microsoft goes into the weeds.
Well, certainly there are lots of those kinds of examples, and I think the iPad is one of the, and Apple is one of those very, very rare examples of a company that's gotten it right. Because all the drivers in our marketplace and our economy are toward get big, get cumbersome, get fat and happy. We will reward big consolidation. We will reward big stock prices. How do you, this is, you're talking about a different kind of alchemy here. We have to re-engineer that thinking.
Well, and there's a lot of talk about this, and a lot of it, you know, they call it the double bottom line, and there's some other buzzwords, and I'm not a philanthropist. I believe in the philanthropy of a guy like Steve Jobs, his contribution to society was improving society and creating a lot of jobs for a lot of people and building an economy. And so to me, it's not a matter of, you know, what cause do you give to after you've made your money, but it's sort of like, how do you make your money in a way that is... that
creates a cause.
Oh, I like that. Nice turn of phrase there. And so I think of it in terms of, we've been told over and over and over again by the business establishment that the job of the board of directors and the president and CEO of an organization is to increase stockholder value. But this goes very much to Clayton Christensen's point, which is if you try to increase stockholder value by doing it directly, what you do is you ultimately create a toxic company that's going to die. So I look at it in terms of how do you create stakeholder value? Because if you create stakeholder value, you will create something about it. You can buy a company and sell off its assets, and that makes money in the short term, but you kill the company, you harm it. But if you can create value for the stakeholders, then you will, en passant, make value for the stockholders.
So for clarity, differentiate stakeholders from stockholders.
Well, stakeholders include people like users, consumers.
But users just create problems.
Yeah, that's pronounced loser, I believe.
If it weren't for those users, this business would be so much easier.
Another really important stakeholder is your children and your employees. And if what you do as an organization, you set out to create long-term value for your children and for your employees, you create value. And you can call me a starry-eyed idealist, but I believe that if you create value for the next generation and for the people who are working side by side with the guy in the next cube, you will create significant value for anybody who's playing a capitalist role. Whereas if you play a capitalist role, you may or may not create value for stakeholders. And that to me is that's something worth doing. And what's neat about it is it's not only when you're doing something worth doing, people get charged up. They work really hard. They love it. They go, oh, this is great. I'm working for a company that's doing something great in the world. I don't see the downside of that. I think that's a great thing.
Absolutely. And yet, it calls
that'll never work.
It'll never work. We're doomed. Sentimental hogwash. There are those Mr. Potters out there who say sentimental hogwash. All these value things, that's good for you, but I'm in this business, I have to make money, and that's about driving to the bottom line.
And it so isn't. We they're being crushed. I mean, look at the products that dominate the universe today. Facebook, Twitter, Google, they're free. I mean, our economy is utterly transformed and turned upside down. And the old guys who are talking about we've got to make profits and we've got to cut costs, they just sound like shrill voices saying we can't let go of steam power. That's what it sounds like to me. It's interesting. I had a meeting today with a potential client. It's a great big company, giant multi-billion dollar multinational corporation, been around for a million years, and they're kind of saying the stories, the same stories of toxic behavior that I heard 15, 20 years ago, and I'm kind of going, I don't know if these guys are going to turn the corner. I mean, they're talking because they're thinking about turning the corner, but the question is, can they abandon all their toxic behavior that they've been wedded to for so many years? And that's a real interesting question. It's not at all clear to me. I mean, there are so many. Again, it's transformative. Look at like the publishing industry. You know, first the publishing industry, you know, started writing books about technology. Then it turned out that all their manuscripts were written in word processors. Then it turned out that that the distribution of all their books was done by software. And then it turned out that the actual publishing was all done by software. And then it turned out that the companies that began booming were those that were publishing books on software. And the companies that weren't were falling by the wayside. And the ones that took 6 months to evaluate an author's submission kind of just went off into the weeds. And the ones that could process a submission in 2 weeks took over. And so it turns out that while there are some marks out there that have been around for 100 years, the fact is that the publishing industry is a completely new industry that didn't exist 20 years ago. All the players are different. All the business deals are different. The companies that published my two books are completely transformed, and all that remains is the name, and even some of those names have changed. And so so you look at these big companies. They're great, big, giant, huge companies, and there will be companies doing what they do, okay? But it will be new players playing a new game and doing it according to new rules because they're transformed by software.
So we're talking about here really this value shift, right? Is that valuing something different from profit and bottom line, valuing innovation, valuing software even, and when your values are so deeply instilled, I guess the question is, do we wait for these behemoths to just fall over under the weight of their own growth and their old values and expect the new Facebooks and Twitters and sort of this shifted value set of companies to emerge? Or do these large companies, these large organizations, can they make that value shift?
I think 1 in 100 of those large companies are going to make the value shift. Clayton Christensen, in his book, The Innovator's Dilemma, it's a brilliant concept, a brilliant book, mistitled. It is not The Innovator's Dilemma. It is The Well-Tempered Business Person's Dilemma. Because if you do what you're supposed to do as a business person, you're toast. If what you do is you break the rules and do everything wrong, then you've got a chance. But what it means, it's very interesting, is it means that you as a business person can't go around and say, when is this going to be done? Because as soon as you say, when is this going to be done, you drive a message into the heart of any innovative person, which is the schedule is more important than the creation. It's a priority setting thing. It's not like a deadline kills creativity. Deadlines don't kill creativity. Values kill creativity. If you value the clock more than the creativity, that message comes through. So the thing is having a short span of time to work in can be in many ways a goad to creativity. People thrive under that kind of pressure. But when some, you know, seagull manager, you know, the seagull manager, they swoop in, poop all over your idea and then fly away. Comes in and says, when is this thing going to ship? What you do is you go, oh, well, then I don't have to worry about it. You know, that's what they believe is the value for innovation. So what it means is, and I mean, if you study management, that's what you're supposed to do as a manager. You're supposed to come in and make sure everybody's hitting their marks and moving on time. What they do is they tell you how long it's going to take to do X, and then what you do is you ride their tail until they do X in that amount of time. It doesn't work if what you're trying to do is innovate. If what you're trying to do is get stuff off the assembly line in a defined way, in a known way, then sure, that works fine. But I mean, when the assembly lines first were created, when Henry Ford and what's his henchman's name? Anyway, when they first came up with the assembly line, it turned out it was really dehumanizing. And you know, we think that it's a latterly vision. We think that we in the enlightened 21st century look back at the assembly line and say, boy, that's dehumanizing. Well, Henry Ford figured that out in 1905. And he said, yeah, that's too bad. I'm making a profit. And he was okay with that. So what it does demand is a complete restructuring of business as we know it today. And what you see is little tiny startups have brilliant ideas. They do great things. You get a couple of Stanford grad students who invent a new way to weight searches, and they create this thing that turns into this incredible dynamo. And at a certain point, you know, quote-unquote adult supervision is brought in by the quote-unquote, you know, business experts. You know, the venture capitalists want to bring in people who know how to do stuff. And it turns out that when that happens, that essentially is like bringing in a kind of a vaccine against creativity, against innovation. It can't happen again. I mean, if you look at the great innovations in the world, what you'll find is there's a common pattern to all great advances of innovation, great thinking, great products, stuff that changes the world. None of it is done in the presence of good management. Please, I would like to hear a counterexample. He's there.
I know,
like
he's
a specter.
There. He is, and he's going to, I hope, open this conversation to all of you so that you can join us as well.
Good. Well, thank you. I'd like to remind our audience listening at home that this program, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. We're your host for tonight. Our program tonight is Software Alchemy and the Arc of Technology with Alan Cooper, president and founder of Cooper and author of The Inmates Are Running the Asylum, in conversation with Chris Shipley, CEO of Guidewire. So, Alan, I have a question for you, something that I didn't know before. For the record, I would like to say that my partner, Christy Dames, who helped me put this program together, is the one who actually came up with the term software alchemy as the title for this program. So I'd like to give Christy a round. She's the one who coined that title for this program.
Thank you. My time, so it's going on my business card.
So, Alan, here's my question. So you are known as the father of Visual Basic, but you're also known as something that I did not know about you until we sat down and talked, was that you are actually the guy behind personas. I mean, anybody involved with design and business these days hears about personas, but you're actually the one who came up with them. And so how did you go from being a software writer, as you said, to being an interaction designer and doing what your company Cooper does today?
Thank you. Good question. Well, I was a software inventor. I mean, when I started out in the 70s, I started a company, and what we did was we figured out good ideas for software to build, then we designed it, then we built it. Actually, we built it, then we designed it. This was back in the day. And then we packaged it and marketed it and sold it and shipped it and supported it and documented it, and we did everything. And, you know, it's been it was a move towards consolidation. And so I slowly began to reduce the kind of the wedge of the pie that was mine. And I got to the point to where I was just doing the invention, and I would build a prototype and sell it to somebody. That's how Visual Basic was born. I created a prototype and showed it to Bill Gates. I never worked for Microsoft. Pure. And but then, in the successive waves of consolidation in the 90s, which was really the greatest time of consolidation that we've experienced in the software era, even that became really difficult. I mean, at the time, it was mostly just me working by myself, and I had reduced my company down to the number of employees I could manage successfully. I was hoping to win that coveted Employee of the Month award, but never did, you know. But so that's when I decided that I could be a consultant. And let me tell you, it was a real shock to the system for me to try to be a consultant. And I was really surprised when I did that. This was in 1992. But an interesting thing happened as a consultant is I was helping people to be creative about their software, but no longer could I just come up with something good in my head, judge its quality in my head or in front of other people and put it out there. But instead now I had clients who were smart people who were writing me checks who were sitting there and saying, why? You know, that meant that I actually had to explain what it was I was doing. I had to kind of come up with a methodology. And so a lot of methodologies got really cleaned up a lot. I have a long essay somewhere on the interweb. If you Google, I'm sure you can find the origin of personas, where I tell this long, annoying story. But basically, I had a client who was about five companies invented what is now called business intelligence at the same time, and this is one of the companies who was inventing it, and they were working with me on design, and I kept saying, well, what does your product do? And they said, well, it can do this, it could do anything. A litany I'm sure you've heard. And it was really frustrating because I couldn't pin them down. I couldn't design something that did anything for anybody. I had to pin it down. And so I started doing some research. I started talking to their clients and their potential clients. And some very clear and very obvious patterns emerged really quickly. And I didn't want to come to them with the name of an actual client that they knew, so I cooked up a fake name, this woman named Cynthia, who is a business analyst, and I came and a couple other people, and I presented them the next day to the client, and I was shocked to see the power. Whereas heretofore I had been saying to the client, here's what I think you should do. And when I came in with a persona, I said, here's Cynthia. She's going to use your product. Here's what she thinks you should do. If any of you have read any of the work by Cliff Nass and Byron Reeves, it just seems like an absolutely trivial difference, but it's astonishing how powerful that is, that removing the desire from you to somebody else. And so that's really the real origin of personas. And this is one of those things that I've gotten a lot of credit for, and people have used them, and they've been incredibly successful. And at the time, you know, I just thought it was just a throwaway piece of nothing, because I came up with a dozen other really good design tools that at the time seemed much more momentous, much more profound, and much more useful. But that just shows to go you is that. I mean, I tell this to people outside of the industry. I'd say, well, I'm famous for the concept of designing software for the people who are going to use it. It's always good for a laugh.
Well, if we have other questions, if you'd like to come around, please, and come up to the microphone. Tell us about. Some of the work that you guys do today. I mean, so we're talking about the arc of technology and where you started 20 years ago and where you're at. What are the kind of things that you and Cooper do today?
Well, we do, most of the people that we do work for are big companies, and they hate to have us talk about it because everything they do is top secret. So that's why I have a list here. So let's see. Well, we do a lot of work for really big companies, and that's because big companies, I think, really understand and value process, and they understand and value rigor, and I think that a lot of the small organizations are they're chronically underfunded, and it actually takes a lot of money to do studied work, and so we don't do a lot of really small startup stuff, and I think I lay that on the doorstep of the venture community, because I don't think they understand this invest in making people love you as opposed to keeping your costs down so that you'll ship cheaply. We just did a project for a company called TaskRabbit, and they just had a really nice rollout. And it's just this remarkable concept of, you know, you want something done, just a little task around the house. You want somebody to pick up your dry cleaning or go to the grocery store. So you can look on your mobile and say, I want somebody to pick up my dry cleaning. And people out there could say, yeah, I'll do that. I'll do it for $15. And somebody else says, well, I'll do it for $12. And you can find references and cross-references and find and choose somebody, and they'll go do it for you. And so Cooper, you know, was really able to – the problem with what they're doing is they're inventing something that nobody really knows how to do. So the problem at hand is how do you help them maintain their focus? The problem, as usual, isn't coming up with the right idea as much as it is not wasting cycles on all of the wrong ideas. I mean, virtually all of our clients come to us with their – they know the right idea. They know the solution to whatever problem they've got. But they also have hundreds of other really bad ideas that all have advocates. And our job is you know, letting the air out of the tires of the bad ideas without pissing people off and letting the good ideas go forward.
Good, thank you. We're going to turn it over to our audience now. If you could just kind of look towards the camera so we can capture this on video as well.
That's your good side, right?
Hi, just before we spun off to the question session, you alluded to the fact that every great innovation in history boils down to a series of I don't know, factors involved, and it does not include management. But you didn't. Can you elaborate on what it does include? What are those factors that you believe are important and are you see?
Well,
repeating.
Thank you. That's a really good question. You know, Larry Keeley, a brilliant design theorist, says, creativity, you can't beat it out of people with a stick. But good managers have tried. Business people talk about doing things to encourage innovation. And I think that's the silliest thing in the world. I don't think that you have to encourage innovation. Trying to encourage innovation is like trying to encourage the sun to rise in the morning. You know, the sun's going to rise in the morning. It doesn't matter what you do. You don't really need to encourage it. What happens is that innovation is actively discouraged and squashed inside organizations. That's really what most conventional management is and how it's implemented, how it's interpreted to be. There's an enormous amount of innovation everywhere, and not everybody innovates, but everybody participates in a web of innovation, and inside any organization there is a lot of innovation going on. What you have to do is just not squash it and seek it out, and it's there. And this is, I mean, when I say that the one thing that is never present is good management, but I don't qualify what it is because there is no pattern for innovative organizations. Innovative organizations are, you know, I think of the woman who invented whiteout, you know, was like a madman era typist, a woman who was in an era when women didn't do that kind of stuff and wasn't taken seriously. And, you know, we tend to think of a couple of really smart young, you know, grad students, but it can come from anywhere, really.
Okay, our next question, please.
Could you speak a little bit about how we will educate / enable the next generation of alchemists and innovators?
Educate. Well, it's really interesting. You know, thank you. That's a great question. You know, our education system is really was really invented to serve the industrialized world. It was an educational system that was created to take young men off the farm and put them on the assembly line. And it's not a coincidence that our educational system looks a lot like an assembly line. And I know when I went to school, there was, you know, if you looked at the paper of the guy next to you, that was called cheating, and you got in trouble for it. Today it's called playing well with others, and you have to do it. And it's so I see a very different way of thinking from the millennials, the young generation who have cooperated in school. And it's very different from people of my age. You know, Kurt Vonnegut's the guy who said, "True terror is when your high school class is running the world." And and my high school class learned old school ways, you know. But the new, we have got to abandon some of the shibboleths of the educational system of monolithic testing and grading, and we've got to start understanding that there's no longer any point to pouring information into young children's heads because they have the internet in their pocket. So they simply don't need information. What they need is the wisdom to know how to use it. And you get that by working and doing. And this goes back to innovation is the hands of the hands-on. Is what we need to do with our young people is let them get their hands on. I like the work that Dean Kamen's doing with FIRST. The problem is that's kind of a first world sort of solution. I think there's a lot of entrenched interests that are working really hard to take education back to the good old days of good values, and I came from those days, and they weren't that good, and the values weren't that good, and I don't want to go back there. I don't think that's a good source. I'm not saying it was a bad system. I'm saying it was a bad system for the world of today, and today it's a bad system for the world of today. Back then it was an okay system for the world of then. If what you were going to do is get a job at Ford Motor Company on the assembly line, high school was a good thing. So,
okay, let's have
that's a tough problem. That's a real tough problem. Bring along a lunch.
Thanks, Alan. So let's have our next question, please.
Well, Alan, I think you've characterized the role of the manager in corporate America, especially among multinationals, very, very well. What do the new managers look like? What resources do they need, and what kind of information or background do they need?
Boy, thank you. Another really good question. How come you people are so smart? That's scary. You know, I've been working with a group of people for the last couple years here in San Francisco and in New York, and we've actually had some meetings overseas. We struggled for a long time who we were and what we called ourselves, but it was a bunch of programmers who had really embraced agile software development methods, and of course a bunch of interaction designers. I kind of represented the interaction side, and you know, we were for so long we've been artificially held apart with polarized desires and polarized ways of thinking. But the wonderful thing about agile development is it says, as a software developer, you must take responsibility for creating a good product as opposed to taking responsibility for creating a good program. Well, all of a sudden that lifts your eyes up out of the code and looks at a bigger solution. And it's a really revolutionary thing in the world of software development. And as I've said, if you do real agile, the first thing you do is you say, "Where's the interaction designer? I need to work with an interaction designer." And And so they become best friends. Well, it turns out that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of organizations and developers out there who are doing Agile in name only. As there are the same number of organizations that are doing interaction design in name only. But the ones who are doing real Agile development really are looking to find ways to work with interaction designers. And the ones who are doing real interaction designers are going, this is really great. It's Agile opens up development like a flower. I used to characterize development organizations as the Death Star. There were these closed worlds that stay out. And they you know, if you forced them, they'd give you a deadline. Yeah, we'll ship on such and such a date. But there was no visibility at all into the process. What Agile does is it inverts that paradigm. It says, we won't tell you when, but you can see right clear through to what we're doing. And so a group of about 20 developers, there were probably about 30, half of them developers, Agile developers, and half of them interaction designers, and a few testers and a few project managers who came together and said, okay, we get it. We're going to work together. What does that look like? And it's been a really interesting process of trying to get to understand that. And it took me a long time to get it too, because I had the same barriers in my own head. And I was at one of these meetings where I was talking about how we're going to extend the boundaries of the in-group, and one guy came up to me and he said, Alan, it's all us. We're all in the in-group. And that's when I realized is that as soon as you draw a boundary and you say, well, here's the practitioners and here's management, you've recapitulated the same old problem. So you can't do that. So his point is it's all us means that the only way you can build systems effectively and support innovation is if everybody is on the team. You're on the team if you can contribute to the team, if you help direct the team. Now, not everybody on the team does the same thing, but you can't direct the team from outside by definition because it's a self-directed team. You can have people inside the team whose job it is to contribute direction, okay, but they can't contribute direction by force of authority. They can only contribute direction if the team accepts that it's the right direction to go. Now, all of you guys who are well-schooled in the world of industrial age behavior go, well, that's incredibly wasteful because a bunch of those teams are going to do a bunch of stupid things because we're full of stupid people who make mistakes who are going to say, you know, a team gets together and says, we're going to go in this direction. Everybody on the team says, yeah, we're self-directed, we're going in that direction, and it turns out it's the wrong direction. But it turns out that wasting resources or being redundant, which was antithetical to the industrial world, is actually okay. In the post-industrial world, what's not okay is failing to innovate. And in order to innovate, you have to go down some of these blind alleys. And what you have to be able to do is you have to discover that as a group you're going down a blind alley and be able to pull yourself back. That becomes the significant problem. So it turns out that what you need is a team that doesn't have, I call them alien orders. Ignore alien orders. Anybody outside of the team, they're going to throw their little hand grenades of stuff. They're going to do the seagull management thing. And what you do is you just ignore them because they mean nothing, okay? And so management then becomes a matter of facilitating the motion of the team, the speedy motion of the team forward and, even more critically, backward. Namely, well, this isn't working. You know, the entrepreneurial community is calling it pivoting. That's a term of art. In my first company, we pivoted a couple of times in the mid 70s. Only we didn't call it pivoting. We called it, oh crap, this isn't working. Little did I know
it was so much better, doesn't it?
Pivoting is just way cool. But yeah, so. Software development is changing and evolving. It started out hard, and it continues hard. Interaction design is difficult. It's complicated. It started out hard. It continues design. Project management is tough. Testing is tough. All the little details of dealing with the technology, they're difficult. The one that will bust you, the one that's incredibly hard, that's insanely problematic, is management. It's really, really difficult, and it's topsy-turvy. It's upside down. All of the fundamental, iconic principles of this is the right way to do things, to a large extent, no longer apply and are counterproductive. I mean, it's not just you need to attenuate the way you do that stuff. It's you need to invert it. You need to subvert it utterly. And as a programmer, my job is tough. As an interaction designer, my job is tough. As a manager of innovation in a software, in a post-industrial world, my job is a bear. It's really, really hard. And if you're not feeling the pain, Mr. Manager, you're probably not doing it. It's really hard.
How would you tweet that, Alan? How would you tweet that answer?
If it's not hurting, you're not doing it right. It's okay. Kind of counterintuitive, isn't it?
Well, unfortunately, we've actually reached the point in our program where we only have time for one more question. But I'm going to open it up for two questions and ask that you please give us a Twitter-like answer for each of them. I would like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Software Alchemy, the Arc and the Arc of Technology with Alan Cooper in conversation with Chris Shipley. So we have two quick questions with two lightning round answers for you, and then we're out of time.
So one of the few areas in which our Congress and our executives seem to have built a consensus recently is supported, I think, as a way of encouraging innovation and invention, and it's called patent reform. I just wondered if you had any thoughts on this subject.
In 140 characters.
114 characters, huh?
After many years, I have arrived at the conclusion that all forms of intellectual property protection are doing more harm than good. I am a professional who has lived by invention and copyright and patent and innovation all my entire professional life, and I believe that throwing it all that lawyerly protection out would be better for us as a society. It would be better for the stakeholders, it would be better for the children, and it would be better ultimately for the stockholders.
Very good. Okay, and our last question for the evening.
Thanks, good question.
Everybody asked all the questions I wanted to ask.
Yeah.
Alan, open source or patents? Open source, right? Give it away.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you're going to anyway. Is that your question?
That's the question.
The problem with open source is what programmers want to give us. And programmers don't want to cover the bases of what we as a society want. So while open source is a great solution, it is not, by any stretch of the imagination, the total solution.
Thanks, Alan. Okay, Chris, I'm going to turn the tables and ask you to make a final comment to enlighten everyone here, and then we'll finish with Alan to entertain everyone here.
You know, I'm just sitting here being very enlightened, and you probably noticed I'm scribbling all sorts of notes. I think that this question about innovation and management and chaos leaves us in a place where we really are, in some ways, I think, questioning our values and the values that will be required as we move forward to create to a more creative economy. And I think that's a tremendous challenge for all of us who particularly came up through the assembly line school system and management training programs, for us to let go of those expectations and really embrace this larger unending circle will be a tremendous challenge, and I thank you for posing it, and we'll do our best.
Alan Cooper. At Mr. Alan Cooper is the Twitter handle for Alan. At Mr. Alan Cooper. And at, what is it, at Chris Shipley?
C. Shipley.
At C. Shipley.